And now we'll begin with side two of broadcast number 627, December the 12th, 1983. Novell would have been very nice. He should have said to Larry Flynt, hey, I'll take the $1 million, Larry, instead of working for so much a month. I'll tell you about what happened to John Kennedy, and they'll give me immunity, and then the case will be over. We won't have to worry about it. The case closed, okay? This book on Bob Cutler goes extensively into radio shows he's done, pictures and diagrams, the documentation of the fact that the CIA doesn't have an umbrella, how the umbrella was opened, the use of Gordon Novell, and he's got a picture of him sitting on the curb and headshots and overlays, and he has met him personally and said, I believe you are the umbrella man who sent this missile into Kennedy. And the first autopsy at Parkland Hospital described a missile in Kennedy's throat. Incidentally, the book that Bob Cutler did on Gordon Novell tells about his working for Double Check Corporation in Miami. And in Rebel, the issue, the article I wrote for Larry Flynt, I talk about Double Check, briefly mentioned it, and part of Guy Bannister and the Permandex operation, one of the assassination teams. There were mentions of Mitchell Burbell and also Gordon Novell. In this article tells how he worked for Schlumberger Well Company and Mr. Jean de Menil, M-E-N-I-L, was an associate of George de Morinchild. In The Rebel, I was writing about George de Morinchild and his links, Nazi connections to John Kennedy. I'm publishing an article that Larry's getting out on the Kennedy assassination, and the people I'm writing about, again, are in the House. Now, this book that Bob Cutler did goes into the role of Guy Bannister with his anti-communist League of the Caribbean that was set up by Charles Willoughby that I wrote about in The Rebel. And it tells about Bannister as associated with Office of Naval Intelligence as well as with Lee Harvey Oswald. And, of course, Oswald's role in the Navy intelligence was with John Connolly and Fred Korth, both Secretary of the Navy, and their context to Oswald. So in this book about Gordon Novell and the missile removed from John Kennedy's throat, the testimony of the CIA that they do have a umbrella weapon, they have a cane, and they have a walking cane, and they also have an umbrella, which is a weapon. And the description of the weapon, the man, and so forth. I believe you can get this book from research out in Aptos, California, and I've given you the address. I didn't bring in tonight. I'll bring in another time. The Day of the Umbrella Man by Bob Cutler. It's all about Gordon Novell and the missile and John Kennedy, and that's the man who was at Larry's house and still be maybe paid by him. And this is one reason why we have to have a nice talk and maybe May has to reevaluate. You know, when I went on, this team wasn't there. And there's no reason why I can't leave the ship and leave it while I'm ahead. Bob Cutler has done extensive work. He's a Harvard graduate and retired, almost retired architect who has spent a tremendous long time investigating this incident. Now, there's been a long ad in the newspapers in Washington, D.C. I don't know how many of you have seen it. A full ad on an ambassador to the Vatican with a question mark. Should the president appoint an ambassador to the Vatican? And there were several articles this past week. Reagan making new push to formal ties with the Vatican. The opponents say it would be unfair to favor the Catholics. Another one, the U.S. explores closer Vatican relations. Now, this is literally an emergency. And I'm going to give you the address of a church group you can write to. It's Right to Public Affairs and Religious Liberty, 6840 Eastern Avenue, Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20012, or telephone 202-722-6688. They claim that there should be separation of church and state, that is very imperative that we separate and not have an ambassador going back and forth. Now, Licio Gelli was at Ronald Reagan's administration and funded Ronald Reagan and works with Alexander Haig and Michael Lindeen and the entire Center for Strategic Study. He's a bigwig in Washington, and he's now in Argentina. He fled from a Swiss jail. He was a man who worked for Franco. He set up the equivalent of the Gestapo for the Italian, for Mussolini, and then he ran Hitler. He worked for Hitler's Nazis in Italy when Mussolini fell. And then he fled to Argentina and came back to Italy and had the notorious P2 Masonic scandal with 1,000 members of the government that were ready to put in a Nazi dictatorship in Italy. And the present pope works with Hermann Abst of the Vatican. He works with the Vatican Bank, and Abst was then head of the Deutsche Bank and IG Farben, and made Zyklon B, the gas for the concentration camps. And to send an ambassador from just the Vatican, which is just a few miles large, to Washington, D.C., gives a exchange going back and forth. And I'm sure that Michael Sindona wants this, too. He built the Watergate Hotel. The Vatican had their investment, put that up. Sindona is in jail for breaking down not only the Franklin National Bank for $45 million, but banks in Europe, and funded closely tied to Richard Nixon, the Republican Party. There's an element of fascism and far-right-wing Nazis, actual Nazis, not neos, from the first war. And it's very important to separate, because then the money can flow back and forth to get them out of bail. The Vatican was caught with $1.2 billion in the Bahamas and Panama dummy fronts linked to drug smuggling and to weapon smuggling. And how to extend the Vatican to the White House is to open the door then to one church group. I can't think of any other single church group that's been identified and proven in the courts to have this notorious record with coming down politically on every priest or Jesuit who wants to make social change. So starting with Pius XII, who was actually funding Hitler, just putting the money in his hand, and Mussolini and Franco. If you want fascism and you want them to have bagmen running in and out of the rooms, the ambassadors, two-way running in and out, instead of isolating them until they come forward with where the money went. There's 10 dummy fronts, 10 doorknobs with no buildings, with several hundred million dollars. If you don't want to know where that went, okay. But if it's going to buy fascism, to buy newspapers, to take away your rights, it's important to separate that. The Bonn, Germany had an article this week. West German Nazis vow they will rise again. There's a party starting up meeting in Munich. If you have unlimited money, you can rise again. That's easy. There's no problem with that. Now, in the remaining time, I want to talk about provocations, because in the article on Larry McDonald that's in Hustler this month, it brings up the question of mind control of the pilots flying the 007. And this article is the first article published to suggest what happened to this particular plane that was sabotaged. As I mentioned a few weeks ago, a member of the CIA said that Ronald Reagan literally provoked this to increase the war tension and the anti-communism. And he's 20 years with the CIA, 25 years. And there are all kinds of theories on the 007, but not one of them, and I brought in some of them to share with you tonight, can come up with any logical explanation that's any better than the one that is in the Hustler, the February Hustler on Murder Incorporated. And incidentally, the Larry McDonald pie there covers two sections of Larry McDonald's complicated life, the 007 and Western Gold's Nail APD. But when I get to the Granada story, we'll go to other sections of the Larry McDonald pie and the John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy murder and so forth. It all ties into these people. Now, after that came out, we heard the word kamikaze, which we haven't heard since World War II. Hardly the Japanese troops, in the news everywhere. And there's a story this week. Reagan voices his concern over kamikaze terrorists. And he refers to the brain-controlled terrorists that bombed the embassy in Lebanon. And the word kamikaze, San Jose Mercury in Washington Post, big black letters. It was never really mentioned before. There's provocations going on now, and the word is terrorism. And one good way to lose your rights is to get sucked into terrorism. Ronald Reagan is turning Washington into an armed camp with cement barriers, electronic devices, missiles at the airport, turning us into a state of terrorism. And at the same time, he worked with Ramsey Clark and Califano, the people involved with the Grenada government, and Robert Vesco on that notorious garden plot. When Reagan was governor of California, it was a plan laid out by the Pentagon in Georgia to overthrow this country called the Garden Plot. And I can go back and pull that out and share that with you. And looking at my Grenada articles, there's Califano, who Sir Eric Gary went to when he was kicked out by Maurice Bishop, and says, "Help me overthrow Bishop." And Califano and Hagen, Kissinger and Carrington go in to shift gear and do that. And Ramsey Clark is the attorney for Cord, who killed Maurice Bishop. And they were in the garden plot. So the level of terrorism to overthrow the country isn't very far away from Ronald Reagan's past as governor with the same teams. Now he's president of the United States. And Pravda had an article this week. They said that U.S. imperialism is the leading suppressor of human rights and freedom and accused the Reagan administration of raising terrorism to the level of official policy. Now, some of you don't remember, you don't have a recall, or you weren't here, but take your 8 years in California with the SLA, the Seminese Liberation Army, the Manson family, the Isla Vista, the People's Park, the San Quentin killing of George Jackson, the Marin County, the judge, the San Quentin Six trial, the Soledad brothers down here, the mutiny trial of the soldiers that came down to Fort or down here in California near Carmel. It's right outside of Carmel. We had an experiment on the mini garden plots, and the LAPD was involved in all that, and LAPD is in charge of the security for the Olympic Games. And so the Soviet Union is saying that we're making this official policy. Now, what kind of provocations have we had? For example, here's a story out of the New York Times, big black letters in the LA Herald. The United States overlooked the Beirut warning. They had letters one inch high. Secret bulletin predicted the attack. Another article, it's by Philip Talman, but down in, this is a reprint from the San Jose Mercury. U.S. intelligence warned the Marine Beirut hit likely. Why did that happen? That happened one day after the Grenada invasion, and they had 3 days warning. They knew the Grenada invasion was coming down because they planned it carefully in escalated stages from 1980 up to 83, and they synchronized a day apart. And just shortly after the Korean airline, which was September the 1st, and then the killing of the Koreans in Burma. Another story in the San Francisco Chronicle by General John Vesey Jr., the head of the Army. U.S. still doesn't know who bombed the Marine base in Beirut. The reason they don't know is that I think Ronald Reagan had this as a major provocation, like our California violence, simultaneous within 24 hours to the Grenada. Now, the New Times, a magazine that comes out weekly from the Soviet Union, went into the provocations of the South Koreans killed in Burma. And they called it a provocation and an excuse for a declaration of war. Remember when Mr. Aja was shooting at the Pope and the Pope had died? It would have been an excuse for a war invasion into Bulgaria and the Soviet Union. The New Times explains that the president of South Korea rearranged the motorcade, it sounds a little bit like Dallas, and changed the time and day and had what he called a miraculous escape, that Chun Do Wan, H-W-A-N, set the arrival a few minutes different than the others so that he survived it and called it divine intervention. They brought out another point that he sent people down there ahead of time and after they made the arrangements and carefully told him, you know, what time or where at this particular monument with the wreath would be put down. Then he himself knew in advance there'd be an explosion, they said, because then after it was carefully arranged, he changed it. And then they brought out the fact that within a few hours after the cabinet shifted and they changed the entire cabinet after the shooting, he had people appointed immediately, and it would be impossible to lose six or seven people of your cabinet and then have a new cabinet appointment right on the spot from the moment they're dead. It was like Lyndon Johnson making sure that his CIA friend, Judge Sarah Hughes, made him president within an hour after Kennedy was dead. She happens to be a lifelong friend of his and from the CIA, and she's holding the Bible. Now, down in Burma with this South Korean incident, they go on to explain that when the cabinet changed, the major change took place, but the two people he didn't change were the chief of the National Security Agency and his own bodyguards. And if they were remiss in all this, they would have been off. So when a newspaper article says there was a confession down there, it doesn't mean anything necessarily. There was a confession in El Salvador about the killing of an American GI, and then it came out about a week and a half ago that he was forced and tortured into a confession. And then they're giving the men the death penalty, so you'll never know whether or not it was a provocation. Now, in Washington, the FBI says the Capitol bombings are like other blasts, and they refer to an armed resistance group. That's like the Seminese Liberation Army. We spent $22 billion a year for intelligence between the defense and the CIA, Navy intelligence, $22 billion. And isn't it funny that every incident that could cause World War III or set off some terrible repressions and instigations is never heard of by anybody before? It's like in California, the SLA, the Vince Ramos was infiltrated. The United Prisoners Union was infiltrated. The Panthers was infiltrated. The women's organizations. And then all of a sudden, the Symbionese creature pops out of nowhere. And in Washington, it's called the Arms Resistance Unit. So on the basis of a bombing where a few art pictures went down and nobody was hurt, they are. There's a picture of the Capitol policeman with metal detectors. There were sandbags. There's new X-ray machines added to security buildings, concrete barriers. And the latest is missiles at the airport that can shoot with 1 minute any airplane that they think would be going into the White House that lands at an airport in New York. So the story is explosion rocks Capitol, causes no injuries. And in return, the Capitol of the United States of America, never before, is an armed camp, so that you get a warfare mentality. If he pulls the garden plot with his Ramsey Clarks and Califanos and so forth, and Mr. Beckwith and the whole Olympic gang, if they have one incident and pull the martial law plan, they have all the barriers so you can't get in there, and he is protected in advance. Now, as far as the Korean airline, to update the article that is in the Hustler on the Korean airline, a few items. The U.S. taxpayers spent, $500 million or $50 million? I forget the exact figure. I didn't look it up for the Glomar Explorer. Remember how they brought up a Russian ship and gave them a service and then dropped them back in the ocean? It scrapes the bottom of the earth and moves around. Well, when they were looking for the Korean airline, the Glomar was going to rest. Now, they've put it at the end of its line. It served 15 years. The taxpayers paid for it, but they didn't send it to the waters off of Japan and Korea to find that airline. Why? Because the machinery would show it was a spy ship with the cameras maybe floating. So instead of using what the taxpayers paid for to pick up the Glomar, they're going to dry dock it now and take it apart because the evidence they find may show what the Korean airline was doing. Another story from the New York Times that updates a computer input error suspected in Korean Airlines' bad course. Now, they're trying to look for something. The theory is that a one-digit 300-mile human error was made in putting the takeoff location into onboard computers. I love to update these articles because what I do is I take a hypothesis, take all the information that fits into it, and write it, put it on the air, and date it. And then after that, I wait to see if anybody can refute my original allegation a week later, a month later, a year later. And so they're floundering like for the DeLorean money and for the Korean airline, and I enjoy it thoroughly. Another story I put on the air just 2 weeks ago was the CIA agent who said that Ronald Reagan created the incident. His name is John Keppel. Now, another story this week on the computer miscue scene in Korean disaster. And there's a quotation from the investigators in Canada looking into the Korean airline. And they said, whatever scenario you choose, you have to conclude that the crew wasn't paying much attention. Do you believe that the president, the flyer, the pilot for the president of South Korea, and carrying the most controversial congressman that he's had in a long time, like Larry McDonald, who's close to the Korean government, that one of three of those pilots didn't want to live? And then another story came out this week, human error on Flight 7. They came to the conclusion that it was a human error. And if there was a conclusion based on this investigation from the International Civil Aviation Organization, it would undercut the Soviet contention that the airline plane was on a spy mission. It couldn't be a spy mission if a human made a mistake. Then out of Airline Magazine, a listener sent me this, and I appreciate these articles. Anything you send to me, like the congressional speech of Henry Gonzalez and things out of car magazines and reports I get on DeLorean Motors. And this is one on Airline Magazine, and it's about going the airplane going down by the pilots. And this author says, if the Japanese air defense radar saw the 747's transponder return and could report the time exactly that the plane went down, why didn't the Japanese report the airline's deviation earlier? And I wasn't sure, this author said, that the Soviets knew what they were shooting. Then it goes on to say that another idle puzzle, why are Korean airlines the only type to wander into Russia and get forced or shot down when every other airline stays clear? Then they ask the article, these are pilots, what caused the airline Flight 007 to wander so far off course? We probably will never know the reason. Now, I love that answer. The minute you get close to the real reason, whether it's who killed Kennedy or Martin Luther King or Robert Kennedy, then we get these grandiose stories. Well, we'll never know the answer because some people are getting close. They have to tell you, you'll never know. It says we'll never know the reason why, and the aviation authority said the airline's initial systems have offered theories to explain how Captain Byung In Chun managed to maneuver his 747 so far. But it was it says Chung made his critical error while inserting a waypoint into the three inertial navigation system that guided the airspace. But they wondered how in the world he could get to the wrong direction. And they gave statistics that were so outrageous that it would be almost impossible, just impossible to have the machinery go off. And they cited these figures. They said, could all three of the Korean Flight 007's nav systems give identical but incorrect course information? This is from the Pilot magazine on airplane pilots. The chances must be in the hundreds of millions. It could all three have been influenced by some surface or onboard force. The chances are be so remote they hardly deserve attention. Did the crew commit a gross programming error that went undetected for an entire 2 hours? Possibly. It doesn't fit the facts. It says they could radar could cross-check a mistake within minutes. And the crew was Korean, a product of a regimented society responsible not only for their lives, but Americans, and they would know. Could it have been a hijacking? The pilots asked. That's an interesting possibility. With a madman in command, Captain Chung would likely have risked interception to keep his airplane flying. Most pilots would. And he would keep a civilian passenger plane going. So my contention with the high level sophistication of mentally programming people, and this was originally tested in Korea, in Korean hospitals and the CIA, that he didn't really know that he was going down. He went right into the clouds. And as I said before, or put in the end of that article, what's it all about, Alfie? They're trying to figure out what his last words mean. That has, say, Delta. And the editorial, there's an editorial, interestingly enough, in the newspaper this week, and the title of it is What's It All About, Alfie? And it's about the university professors having sex with students at Berkeley. But it's an interesting thing because I took it from a song that I like, and I was describing Larry McDonald's rotten life with all these thieves and crooks and murderers and assassins and gold smugglers and drug smugglers and dictators and head of the Birch Society and making people believe that he's one thing, leading this double or triple life and buying guns under the names of people who are dying and prescribing Laetrile when it won't cure their cancer. And when it's all over, he's dumped in the ocean, literally alone because not one of his aides was with him. And I said, what's it all about, Alfie? And that's in the article. So that was in an editorial this week. At the end of the article, I have that. Now, a gentleman, Ernest Lefevre, wrote a story for the Washington Times one day after Larry McDonald was dead. And just as the appointments were made in South Korea, quickly after the top aides were killed in Burma, and that provocation, the excuse for that provocation, was to cut off all trade of North Korea with Burma, which they quickly were forced to do. And a provocation of the right of the 007 letting these civilians go in the ocean got our dander up against the Soviet Union and wanting to cut off trade with the Soviet Union. And again, putting you in a mentality, you see, you have the Burma killings in South Korea right after the 007 with the mass grieving. You have the Grenada invasion, which they planned for a long time, where they switched governments and put in a man funded by Robert Vesco and the Mafia. And Sir Eric Gary is now ready to turn back, who ran his dictatorship and his mongoose squad. And then the Beirut occasion where we bring in more fleets and more soldiers and get a real foot in the Middle East. We had four major provocations. Now, Mr. Ernest Lefevre, L-E-F-E-V-E-R, wrote a large column for the Washington Times, which is published and owned by Reverend Moon, one day after Larry McDonald died. And it had such details in it, you wonder how he could write it in that one day. And in the article, he says the Soviets are brutal. He says it was an unprovoked destruction of a Korean plane. He says the Soviet Union is run by a scofflaw regime, S-C-O-F-F-L-A-W. Don't hear it often. He said they're not constrained by the norms of civilized behavior. He said they have a long record of repression at home. Then he goes into Alexander Solzhenitsyn, and he tells about how people who suffer in tyranny. And then he says millions of boat people attempted to flee communism. And he has a long list of charges about the world knows about the rape of Afghanistan, and we know about the victims of Yellow Rain, and we know about the plight of Poland. This is one day after Larry McDonald goes down. Now, Ernest Lefevre is on the board of the Office of Strategic Trade with Fritz Kramer and Daniel Graham, who Daniel Graham is works with John Rees and the late Larry McDonald of Western Gold. So Lefevre is not new to this outfit. In other words, Lefevre, who's writing this article about the Soviet Union, he's well known as a far right winger, works with Fritz Kramer and Daniel Graham. And Daniel Graham works with the late Larry McDonald, who 12 days later was to appear in the Los Angeles Police Department and say why he gave a $100,000 computer to take information from the time Reagan was governor in California through those years of terror, the anti-war movement, the signing for abortions, the peace treaties, and so forth, putting that into a computer going back to the Defense Department. So Lefevre has a very tight, long article published by Reverend Moon one day after Larry McDonald went down with links to John Rees, Daniel Graham, Fritz Kramer, and Larry McDonald. So did he have foreknowledge? Did he have his little speech written? I mean, how far does this go? As I say, talking about Vietnam, the Yellow Rain, Afghanistan, Poland, and he says this brutality refers to the brutality and so forth. It is a real Cold War speech written by Ernest Lefevre, president of Ethics and Public Policy Center and co-editor of the apocalyptic premise, Nuclear Arms Debated. But they don't say he's also on the board of strategic trade with Daniel Graham and Fritz Kramer. And Mr. Rees of Western Golds was the one who put works with J. Peter Grace and Otto Ambrose and getting back. They have a goal. They work with the Galen people in Germany, the Western Golds. So Lefevre takes a provocation that serves everybody's purposes to whip up this Cold War into a hot war. Now, these interlocking things that I'm talking about are typical of California when Reagan was governor. You have to go back to those 8 years, and sometime I'll update an article in Rebel on the California violences, the Garden Plot, Ronald Reagan, the mind control at UCLA, the nuke bases I've referred to. Those 8 years were a nurturing ground. Now he's in Washington. See, he was California's problem, and California didn't expose him when he was running for governor. You all saw sat back and thought, well, I'm too much into my own thing, and I'm just going to eat my health foods and take my yogurt and do my yoga, and I'll be okay. It isn't that simple. As a matter of fact, there was a program with two men, Mr. Sagan, who does the thing on space stations, and Ehrlich, Paul Ehrlich from Stanford. And they were saying on TV this week about the nuclear bombs, if you don't spend 10% of your time working in politics or working for peace, you're not going to live long. This was literally, it was a CNN, an interview of two men who helped them build bombs, helped them build space stations, went the establishment route all the way, and then finally said, if you're a person who cares, if you have children, parents, family, friends, any kind of reality, fight this thing now and spend your time doing it. Well, our time is up now. This is KAZU FM in Pacific Grove. It's Mae Brussel, and I'll be back with you next week. And in the meantime, until Paul isn't coming in with the music, so we'll do a little bit of, here's somebody. Here's a crew for fundraising. You guys, around the team is all here, and they're ready to come in. Did you get any calls? I told them not to call for the hour. Well, we're on now. I want that you all. Now you can send your checks and interrupt anybody else's program but mine and send the money, and they'll be in the other room to take the calls, and I'll be back with you next week. Bye-bye.
Well, thanks very much, Mae Brussel. Oh, what a pleasure. What a pleasure to listen to that lady, I'll tell you. And she walks out of the room, and what happens? The fellow phone rings. My golly. Probably a CIA chasing her down or something.
What'd you say? What'd you say?
I said it was probably the CIA calling you.
You
want to
come to the house.
Okay. Come and get your famous stew. Potluck dinner there. Oh, boy. What a pleasure to have her here.